What I want to start with, I want to start you off with a thought that I think is a particular challenge. Now, you may recall from previous years that a Bible verse I like is Joshua 1:8, and that's, I consider to be a very fundamental verse to any Christian endeavor, but Joshua 1:8 very simply says, "This book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night, that thou mayest observe to do according to all that is written therein. Then shalt thou make thy way prosperous, then shalt thou have good success." The premise of that verse being that if we can get into God's principles and apply God's principles, we'll be successful in our endeavors. Now, one of the ways that we know that to be true is as I've shown you in previous years, the statistical indicators. I've shown you a lot of charts and a lot of things in previous sessions where that I can statistically prove that when God's principles are implemented societally, they have statistical impact in a positive way. But now, there's a different way of looking at that verse too, and that's from the standpoint of history. So I want to begin this session today with a statement by a president of the United States. And this president was an accomplished historian. This guy was an avid historian, wrote lots of history books. And in his study of history, his use of history, he made a statement that's very beneficial for what we'll look at today. He said, "A nation that does not remember what it was yesterday doesn't know what it is today or what it's trying to do." He said, "We're trying to do a futile thing if we don't know where we've come from or what we've been about." Now, that particular statement on history, on the importance of history, on the importance of knowing where we've come from and what we've been about, has a lot of truth today. But even for a Christian, it has a lot of significance. I mean, just from a Christian standpoint, we should be historians, not necessarily by our choice, but by God's choice. You ever notice how much emphasis God puts on history? He calls us to remember the former days, to recall the former days. He calls us to record things. When he sent the children of Israel into their promised land in the book of Deuteronomy, he told them, he said, "You make sure you write down and record every victory I've done for you." I call it a victory book. He said, so that whenever you start a new endeavor, you can go back and read to see what I've done for you. It'll give you faith. It'll give you courage to go on to something new because you'll see what I've done for you in the past. So God had them detail that. And then as you look through the scriptures, you look all through the Old Testament, God uses history on a number of occasions to save his people. Remember Mordecai? Mordecai saved the life of Xerxes the king, stopped the assassination attempt, and they recorded that in the history books. Everybody forgot about it, and Haman goes on over here with his plan to kill Mordecai and get rid of him. Well, the night that that was supposed to happen, the next day, the king had insomnia that night. God kept him awake, and he said, "You know, I want to read something. Go get me something out of the library." So they brought him a history book out of the library. He read that history book and saw that Mordecai had saved his life. And he thought, "You know, I don't remember having done anything special for Mordecai, but I see here that he saved my life. I'd forgotten all about that. What can I do for Mordecai?" So the next morning he met with Haman and said, "What should I do for someone special that does something special for me?" And it was that instant at that point in time that saved Mordecai's life, that kept him from being hung on the gallows. And God used history to completely reverse the direction that was going at that point in time. You have another one that happened when Cyrus sent Zerubbabel back to rebuild the temple. He gave him the commission. He said, "Go back. Get this thing rebuilt. I want you getting prayer going in that temple because I want my nation blessed. So you pray for my nation when you get back there." So he sent them back. Well, along came other kings. You had Xerxes and Artaxerxes that stopped the building. And so you've gone through now three kings. And Darius got into the records of Babylon, got into the records, the history books of Babylon. He was reading. He said, "You know, it says right here that we sent Zerubbabel back under Cyrus to rebuild the temple. I don't see that that's ever happened. But it says in our history books that we ordered that to happen. Why hasn't that happened?" And so he started the rebuilding of the temple strictly because God took him back into history and he saw something out of history that was supposed to have happened that didn't happen. So all through the scriptures you have this emphasis on history. God puts a lot of emphasis on it. 1 Corinthians 10 is nothing but a history lesson for Christians. It's an Old Testament history lesson that says, learn all of this because this is for our admonition on whom the ends of the earth are come. Another emphasis on history. And then even the book of Judges. Judges is perhaps the best indication of what happens when a people remember their history. You see, when the people and judges knew who they were, what God had planned for them, what their intent was as a nation, they acted completely differently than they did at the times when they forgot who they were and what their intent was and what God intended to do with them. The book of Judges is a perfect example of what happens when people remember their history and what happens when people forget their history and the cycle that goes through that. Now, in a very real sense today in America, we have forgotten a lot of our history. We're moving in directions that were never intended for this nation. We've forgotten a lot about what our founding fathers wanted. A lot of us have not learned it. I think I've pointed out in previous years, the history I'm going through right now is nothing I'd ever been taught in school. I mean, this is out of the old history books. I've enjoyed reading old history books to see what we were, but it's not there in the current history books. But particularly in the area of God, Christian values, Christianity and government, moral values, religious values, we're moving in a radically new direction, and that's the eradication of God and his principles from public affairs. You say, now, wait a minute, that's too big a statement. That's awful broad. You can't say we're wiping God out of public affairs. Well, we're not totally wiping him out, but let me show you the current trend in the courts. Now, there's some interesting things going in the courts. We were just involved in a Supreme Court case just a few months ago. This past Friday, we were contacted. We'll be involved in another Supreme Court case coming up in the future term. So dealing in that arena, dealing in the arena of different legal cases, let me show you some current legal things that are going on. Now, this particular case, and there are a number here, but this particular case is called Warsaw versus Tehachapi. It's from the United States District Court, the Eastern District of California. And in this particular case in California, and this comes from Tehachapi, California, in Tehachapi there is a public cemetery. And inside the public cemetery there's a planter. And that planter was in the shape of a cross. And somebody noticed that and said, wait. That planter, that's the shape of a cross. That's a symbol of Christianity. Separation of church and state. You can't have something Christian out where it can be seen in public. So they filed suit and took it to court. And this is a cemetery, mind you. And in court, the court looked at it and considered it and said, you know, said, you're right, that planter is in the shape of a cross. A cross is a symbol of Christianity, separation of church and state. You can't have a cross in a public cemetery. Get the cross out of the cemetery. Now, the court went on to explain the problem with having a cross in the cemetery. And anytime the court gives you a decision, it will give you a written opinion of that decision so you know why they said what they said. The court said the problem with having the cross in the cemetery is that this cemetery adjoins a public highway. And the court said if you were driving down the public highway, you could actually look into the cemetery and see the cross. And the court said if you were driving down a public highway, looked into a cemetery and saw a cross, the court said that would cause you emotional distress and injury in fact if you were allowed to see a cross driving down a highway. And we go, give me a break. You got to be kidding me. The problem with that is it's a legally binding ruling. That's a legitimate ruling. That cemetery had to remove the cross because of this ruling. That is a valid, it's not a good ruling, but it's a valid legal ruling. And here's another case. It's called Roberts versus Madigan. It's already been through the district court. It's already been through the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and both of those courts have ruled the same thing. This particular case comes out of Colorado. And what's happened in Colorado is in school district in Colorado, they ordered the removal of the Bible out of the library, the school library. They said having a Bible in the public school library violates separation of church and state. You can't have a Bible in the library. They ordered the removal of three books. They ordered the removal of the Bible, a book on the life of Jesus in pictures, and a book on the story of the Bible. Those three books they ordered out of the library. Now, in district court, the argument is very simple. It said, wait, stop, let's use our minds here. There is a section of books in this library on Buddhism. There's a section of books on Indian American religions, and there's three books on Christianity, and you're saying that these three books on Christianity have to go? And the court said, now we understand this is censorship, but you have to understand this is Christianity we're talking about. And the court said, you have to deal with Christianity in schools the same way you deal with, as they said, any other hazardous waste. The same way you remove asbestos out of schools, you have to remove Christianity out of schools. Christianity is different from these other religions. It can't be left in the school. Buddhism, Indian religions, that's okay. That case is now at the United States Supreme Court. The District Court, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals have both upheld the same decision on it. This is a case going on right now in Texas. It's not totally resolved yet. It's called Alexander versus Nacogdoches Independent School District. Now, this particular case, Nacogdoches, Texas, out toward the east, Nacogdoches School District had set up a school assembly for someone to come in and speak at that assembly to the students on an anti-drug program. Had it all set up. And the guy they brought in is a professional. This guy is on the National Policy Board for the Drug Czar's Office. You remember the Drug Czar's Office? Bill Bennett's the first Drug Czar, and former Governor Martinez is the Drug Czar now, former Governor of Florida. So this guy is on the National Policy Board for the Drug Czar's Office. Competent, qualified, professional. And on top of that, he's addressed 3,000 public schools on the evils of drugs. I mean, he is really good at this, and he's a very, very much a speaker in demand as far as addressing schools on the evils of drug use. So he was coming to Nacogdoches. They arranged for him to speak at the school in Nacogdoches. Now, when he came, somebody found out that this guy is known as a Christian. I mean, people know that this man's a Christian, and that would be unconstitutional to have a Christian on campus to speak to the students on drug use. So they filed it with the court, and the court looked at it, and the court went through and said, now, wait a minute. They said, this guy is competent, he's professional, he's qualified in this arena. Furthermore, he's addressed over 3,000 public schools, and the judge says, I have seen many of those videos, and there is not a thing in those videos that would violate this separation of church and state. He doesn't say anything religious in his presentations at all. It's a completely secular presentation. But the court pointed out, however, it is true that this guy is known as a Christian, and therefore having him on campus to speak to the students would violate separation of church and state. So he cannot address the drug assembly there on campus. There's a case that was decided just on November the 8th. It comes out of Pennsylvania. This is the one we're now involved with. This case on November the 8th out of Pennsylvania, called Commonwealth of Pennsylvania versus Chambers. There was a man who took an axe handle and he brutally clubbed to death a 70-year-old woman so he could steal her Social Security check from her. Now they caught him, got the evidence, got everything, took him to trial, and in trial you had all the witnesses, all the forensic evidence, everything. Fairly lengthy trial goes through. It's, all the evidence is presented. This guy is convicted and he's sentenced. Well, in the course of this trial, this lengthy trial, prosecuting attorney read several things out of the state law book on how to prosecute this kind of a case. And in the process of reading that, one of the things he read was a Bible verse. He just mentioned a Bible verse in passing. It took about 2.5 seconds to mention that Bible verse. And so he read that out of the state book in the course of a long, drawn-out trial. We're talking something less than 5 seconds that happened over a multi-day trial. And the state Supreme Court of Pennsylvania just struck that trial down and said it's no good because you mentioned a Bible verse in the midst of that trial. You can't do that. To mention Bible verse is unconstitutional. The guy's off the hook for right now. Now, that is so far from what was intended. But why do we do that? We do that, we allow that, because those people are firmly convinced that this is the intent of the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers never wanted to have any type of religious principle in here. This is the intent. This is what the First Amendment was given us for, with separation of church and state. This is exactly what they intended. Well, we say that because that's what we believe from history. But if we were to know our history, we would rule radically different as we have in previous years. And you see, when you listen to cases like this, and you look at cases like this, and you see how many come now like this, you say, this is bad government. This is not good government at all. And certainly, by the definition given us in Romans 13 or in 1 Timothy 2, you've got to say it's bad government. Because government, number one, is supposed to be, according to the scriptures, a servant of God. And you say, now that's not being a very good servant of God. I mean, making those kind of rulings. And secondly, you find that government is supposed to punish the wicked and reward the righteous. And somehow we've kind of got this thing flopped around. It's the wicked getting off and the righteous getting kicked out. It's not supposed to work that way. That's not good government. And so the cry goes up, we want good government. Let's get back to good government. Well, you know, that's an interesting cry, but it's nothing new at all. We have heard that cry in America for over 3 centuries. At least 3 centuries that we have records, there's been a cry for good government. Now, the way you achieve a good government has always been something that's open for debate. For example, one of the people I'll start with here on good government, this man is John Locke. Now, John Locke was, this is in the mid-1600s, John Locke was a political philosopher. The Founding Fathers used John Locke quite often. As a matter of fact, you'll find that they used John Locke in the first line of the Declaration of Independence. So John Locke was a political philosopher that our Founding Fathers studied quite a bit. But this man was asked by the inhabitants of the colony of South Carolina. South Carolina was forming a state constitution, and they said, we want a righteous government. We want to somehow ensure that we will always have a godly, a righteous government. So can you help us create a government that will be godly and righteous? And so John Locke said, yes. He said, that can be done. He said, what you need for a righteous government is you need good laws. If you can get good laws, if you can form your state, your constitution on good laws, then it doesn't matter the men that run the state. You'll always have good laws. You will always be guaranteed a good government. So he formed the state constitution for South Carolina in 1669. And when he did so, he made a very detailed, meticulous constitution. You do this and this. I mean, there's just laws all over this thing. Laws everywhere, knowing that if you can get good laws, no matter who gets in office, they'll be governed by the laws. Now, that was one approach to keeping a good government. But 12 years later, there was a completely different approach that was taken. 12 years later, this man, William Penn, had been given all the land between New York and Maryland. And that was to be his land. The king called it Pennsylvania against Penn's wishes. He didn't want it named after himself. But that's what the king called it and said, that's what I'm calling it, so that's what it's going to be. And he said, then you come up with a government for it. So he started creating a frame of government for that new territory called Pennsylvania. That frame of government, he had the same problem. How can I keep a good government? What can I do to keep a good government here? And so Penn went at it, but he went at it completely differently. You see, when he gave the 1681 frame of government for Pennsylvania, he said, you know, it's not the laws that make a government good, it's the people in office that make a government good. If you get the right people in office, you'll never have to worry about wrong laws. So what we want to emphasize in this government is keeping good people in office. Now, when he created that frame of government for Pennsylvania, unlike South Carolina, it was very simple. It had 2 laws. It said, whatever's Christian's legal, whatever's not Christian's illegal. That was the simplicity of that government. Just that easy. If it's Christian, it's good. If it's not Christian, it's bad. That's just a simple definition of government. Now, he explained in his writings, and we have really several thousand of the writings of the Founding Fathers, but I want to read to you in Penn's own words why he did the way he did, why he made such a simple government. He explained, he said, governments are just like clocks. They go from the motion that men give them. Therefore, governments rather depend on men than men on governments. He said, if you let men be good, the government cannot be bad. He said, but if men be bad, the government will never be good. He said, now I know that some say, let us have good laws, and it doesn't matter the men that execute them. He said, but let them consider that though good laws do well, good men do better. For good laws may lack good men, but good men will never lack good laws and will never allow bad ones. You see, in his philosophy, you can get good laws, but if you get bad people in office, they're not going to follow good laws. It's not in their nature to follow good laws. They won't do it. He said, if you get good people in office, they'll never allow bad laws, and they'll always follow good laws. He said, the simplicity of government is based on people, not people on government, and therefore, whatever you've got in your people, that's what your government's going to be. So that's the way he approached that. Now, there's been a lot of debate about that over the years, and particularly if you read James Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, he records a speech given by Benjamin Franklin, considered the most famous speech of Franklin's career, given on Thursday, June the 27th, 1787. And in that speech, they were at a real blockage point in the Constitutional Convention. But Franklin pointed out, he said, we have gone through every single written record of every government that's ever existed. He said, if there's a written record on it, we've studied it because we want to know what works and what doesn't work. We've tried to come up with those aspects that history proves works. And that was one of the things they did in that convention. They spent a lot of time going back to see what history taught them. Now, it's interesting to see what our founding fathers did, because you see, what Penn had taught was very much the conclusion of scriptures. The emphasis on good government has got to be on the right people in office, not the right laws. You see, Proverbs 29:2 points that out. Proverbs 29:2 says, when the righteous rule, the people rejoice. But when the wicked rule, the people groan. You see, Proverbs puts it all on the type of people that are in office, not on the type of laws. If you've got good people in office, the people are going to rejoice. The nation's going to be a happy nation, the state, the city, whatever. If you've got bad people in office, you're going to hear a lot of groaning, because we'll groan under the laws, we'll groan under the policies, we'll groan under the morality. We'll groan when bad people are in office, and there's a lot of that going on now. And so from a scriptural standpoint, the emphasis is again on the people, not on the laws. Now, the founding fathers learned that from history. They learned that, you know, John Locke's philosophy sounds good, it doesn't work out. William Penn's philosophy does work out. You get good people in office, it'll make all the difference. So when the founding fathers had opportunity to create their state governments, and they didn't have that for a long time because everything had been run by Great Britain, but when they finally did have opportunity to create their own state governments, it's interesting to see what they put in. Now, what I'm showing you here next will be straight from Supreme Court records. This is the first place I learned it. We've since documented it. But the Supreme Court pointed out that these guys, when they signed that founding document, wiped out state governments. Because up to then, we had been 13 British colonial colonies, 13 British colonial governments. Great Britain had 13 governments in place in all the colonies. And now we've separated from Great Britain, and poof, just like that, there goes state government. We no longer have state governments. So these men are living in states that don't have a government. So they have to go back to their own states and create their first state governments, and they do that. That's why the first state governments, the first state constitutions for the 13 colonies start in 1776. They wiped out government, now they needed to replace it. These same men that signed the founding documents turned around and went home and started creating their state constitutions for the 13 colonies. So you look at the 13 colonies, and look at what we find in there. And this is what the Supreme Court pointed out. You see Delaware? Delaware is very simple. Our founding fathers did this, the same men that signed the founding documents. They said, everyone appointed to office must say, I do profess faith in God the Father, and in the Lord Jesus Christ, his only Son, and in the Holy Ghost, one God and blessed forevermore, and I do acknowledge the Holy Scriptures, the Old and New Testament, to be given by divine inspiration. Now, that, you know, that'd be a wonderful requirement for seminary, but that wasn't for seminary, that's for politics. If you wanted to get in politics, that's what you had to believe. That's higher than a lot of seminaries require now, but that's what the founding fathers... That's what the founding fathers required just to get into politics. Why? Because if we get good people in office that hold these values, that hold these beliefs, we're going to have good government. It's that simple. And you see, the Supreme Court in the 1892 case, Church of the Holy Trinity versus the United States, proceeded to point out that 44 state constitutions, which is how many states we had at that time, 1892, that 44 state constitutions had similar requirements in them. Now, Delaware is pretty strong, but North Carolina was even stronger. North Carolina, it says, no person who denies the being of God or the truth of the Christian religion, or the divine authority of either the Old or New Testament, and look at this, or if you hold religious principles incompatible with the freedom and safety of the state, if you think that God's word does not apply to government, if you think that the principles of the word of God have nothing to do with state government, they said you're not capable of holding any office or place of trust in the civil government of this state. If you think that God's principles don't apply, we don't even want you near public office. I mean, that's a good way to get us all in trouble. We'll get people in office that don't follow God's principles, and then we'll all pay for it. That was a requirement in North Carolina, and this was never a problem with the First Amendment, because the First Amendment was simply set up to establish or to make sure that we would not establish one national denomination. We weren't going to have in America what they had in Great Britain. We wouldn't all be Catholics or Anglicans or anything else. And that's why the First Amendment says Congress will make no law respecting an establishment of religion. We can't, by government, establish a national denomination. And so since this didn't require anyone to be Baptist or Methodist or Lutheran, it was fine. It was not a violation of the First Amendment because it's not a denominational requirement. Now, even as we move through American history, we find how much that was the emphasis when you get into things like textbooks. Let me show you one of the authors of so many of our textbooks. This is Noah Webster. And when we think of Noah Webster today, we say, no, wait a minute, he's the guy with the dictionary. Well, he is, but Noah Webster was the founding father. This guy fought in the American Revolution. He was a long-term politician. He spent 9 terms in the Connecticut legislature, 4 terms in the Massachusetts legislature, 3 terms as a judge, one of the first men to call for the Constitutional Convention, one of the most active in promoting its ratification. If you look in the Constitution in Section 8 of Article 1, that's Noah Webster's handiwork. We have that in the Constitution because of Noah Webster. So Noah Webster's a founding father. But like a lot of the founding fathers, he said, you know, we have given so much to see America established where we are now. It's cost us dearly. It's cost us very severely. We want to make sure that this nation continues on the same course in which we've set it. Now, how do we do that? They said, well, the only way it'll work is if we can transmit to future generations those principles that have made us successful. They said, that means we're going to have to get involved in education, because education is the way you transmit from one generation to the next those things that you'll need to be successful as a people and as a nation. So that's why Noah Webster jumped into writing textbooks. He wrote all sorts of textbooks, spellers, primers, dictionaries. He wrote history books, books on government, books on science, astronomy, you name it. He was writing textbooks. Several of the founding fathers moved into writing textbooks. And when you look at the emphasis they put, now, this is one of Noah Webster's textbooks. This was actually his history book. And this particular history book that I have here in my hand was used as a history book in American schools for about a century. Roughly a century we used this. And he took American history, and he took it from the very beginning, back at the time of Columbus, all the way to where they were at present. And at the conclusion of the book, he had a section on government and on the civic responsibilities of these students. He said, now, you're going to be coming up. You're going to have control of this nation. What can you do to make sure that we keep this on a strong foundation? And so in the back of the book, he had a section that talked to the students about their responsibilities. Let me read you the civic responsibilities as taught by our founding fathers in our public school textbooks. He told them, he said, when you become entitled to exercise the right of voting for public officers, he said, let it be impressed on your mind that God commands you to choose for rulers just men who will rule in the fear of God. He said, the preservation of a republican government depends on the faithful discharge of this duty. He said, if the citizens neglect their duty and they place unprincipled men in office, he said, the government will soon be corrupted. Laws will be made, not for the public good so much as for selfish or local purposes. Corrupt and incompetent men will be appointed to execute the laws. The public revenues will be squandered on unworthy men, and the rights of the citizens will be violated or disregarded. He said, that's what happens if you get ungodly men in office. He said, if a Republican government fails to secure public peace and prosperity, it must be because the citizens neglect the divine commands, and they elect bad men to make and administer the laws. Pretty strong stuff. He says, if you get into a situation with bad government, it's because we ignored the divine commands of God, and we put bad people in office. He said, when you go to vote, he said, you make sure you look at God's qualifications in the life of that individual. If they're not just men who will rule in fear of God, who are godly, God-fearing men, don't put them in office. Because he said, if you do, here's what will happen to your revenues, here's what will happen to your laws, here's what will happen to your social interests. He goes through a great description, and he gave the students a real stern warning at the last part of this section. He talked about how that a society might get into all sorts of evils. He said, all the miseries and evils which men suffer from vice, crime, ambition, injustice, oppression, slavery, and war, all of these evils proceed and despise from neglecting the precepts contained in the Bible. Now, he said, if we get into problems with nations because we're ignoring what the Bible tells us to do. And that was our public school textbook for nearly a century. And actually, this is a book that came out about 10 years before. Oops, that's not the one. This is the one that came out about 10 years before. Another textbook. And this is a book that prepared students for their social responsibilities. It went through manners, it went through customs, it went through social duties, civic duties, political duties, it went through family duties. And listen to what this says. Again, it's the same emphasis, another textbook, the same emphasis on what you do at election time. It says, in selecting men for office, let principle be your guide. Regard not the particular sect or denomination of the candidate, but look to his character. It is alleged by men of loose principles that religion and morality are not necessary or important qualifications for public office. He said, but the scriptures teach a different doctrine. They direct that rulers should be men who rule in the fear of God, able men such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, Now listen to this description. It says, it is to the neglect of this rule, the one that was just given on putting godly men in office, it is to the neglect of this rule that we must ascribe the multiplied frauds, the breaches of trust, the embezzlement of public property which astonish even ourselves, which tarnish the character of our country, and which disgrace the government. And then listen to this strong punchline. It says, when a citizen gives his vote to a man of known immorality, he abuses his civic responsibility, he sacrifices not only his own interest, but the interest of his neighbor, and he betrays the interest of his country. And that's pretty strong stuff. It says, if you put an immoral person in office, you have betrayed the interest of your country. There's no way that an immoral person will do the right things that this country needs. And that's what we taught for years in our textbooks. Now, I think it's worth seeing again out of that Webster textbook what he told the students. He said, let it be impressed in your mind that God commands you to choose for rulers just men who will rule in the fear of God. He said, the preservation of a Republican government depends on the faithful discharge of this duty. And by the way, let me point out that when the Founding Fathers talked about Republican, it was not the Republican Party. That party didn't exist then. In their mind, we were not and were never to become a democracy. It is very clear in their writings. They literally prayed, God, don't let us become a democracy. Always keep us a republic. There's such a vast difference between those two types of government. You'll see them talk about this. You know, we do pledge allegiance to a republic, the republic for which it stands. We were never a democracy. We never intended to be a democracy. They have some of the best statements you can ever imagine about a democracy. But you'll notice that they talk about preserving a republican form of government. That was before the parties existed that we have today. So he said, the preservation of a republican government depends on the faithful discharge of this duty. He said, if a republican government fails to secure public prosperity and happiness, it must be because the citizens neglect the divine commands and they elect bad men to make and administer the laws. Now, that was the warning in our textbooks. That's how we knew that we could keep America on course. That's how we could keep good government. Now, we came to a point where we moved away from what our founders had taught us. We started losing our history. And as we did, it happened really in two ways. And we saw the first traces of it started about 1930. In 1930s, two trains of thought came up that really got big by 1960. But in 1960, one of the trains of thought that had become really, really big was, listen, it doesn't matter what a guy does in his private life. What a guy does in his private life is his own business. It has nothing to do with his capacity to be a good official in government. He still has professional qualifications. And who cares what he does in his private life? That's not our... We shouldn't even look at that. We should ignore that. Just put them in office based on their professional qualifications. Now, that concept of separating the private from the public was something that was brand new. That had never happened before in our history. Actually, there is a great book right here. This is a book that came out in December of 1800. This came out shortly after the death of Washington. It was the most popular book written about George Washington. It went through over 200 reprints, and this book was the favorite reading text of Abraham Lincoln. He loved this book on Washington. This is what he read over and over and over. He went to this book again and again. Now, this book on Washington puts an emphasis, it shows how that they never separated that emphasis, because when it talks about Washington, it tells the students, and this is a book written specifically for students, and it tells the students, it said, no, listen, you may want to be like Washington, it'll never work. We're only going to have one commander-in-chief, we've already had that. We're only going to have one first president, we've already had that. You can never be like Washington in those respects, but you can be like Washington in his character. What was it that made Washington so great? It was his private life. Now let's look at his private life and see what happened with his family and his home, and that's what this book does, is it goes into his private life. Now, listen to the statement they make about it. It said, now Washington has been seen in greatness, but it's only the greatness of public character, which is no evidence of true greatness. For a public character is an artificial one. And at that point, they jump into the description of Benedict Arnold. They said, look, Benedict Arnold was a great military hero, had a great public image, but he was corrupt in his moral character and his private character, and it finally showed up in public. You can't just look at a public person, because that's artificial. If they're corrupt in private, they're going to be corrupt in public. And it continues. It says, it is not then in the glare of public, but in the shade of private life that we're to look for the man. Private life is always real life, and that is where a man will always act himself. It is the private virtues that lay the foundation of all human excellence. And that was the emphasis all the way through this book. Private life is more important than public life. It doesn't matter what your capacities or abilities are. If you don't have the right moral fiber, you'll never make it. And that was the emphasis that we had for a long time. Now, that emphasis was also repeated by this man. This man is named John Witherspoon. And John Witherspoon was one of the patriots, one of the founding fathers. This guy was one of the signers of the Declaration. See if I can get on him right there. You see these four guys seated right here? You got Franklin there, and there's John Hancock. The third man in right there, that is John Witherspoon. A little closer of Witherspoon, you see him seated right there. That's John Witherspoon, and you'll see his signature right there below Stockton. And right there, second one down, Witherspoon. Now, Witherspoon had a great impact on America. Not only was he a founding father, and you saw his ministerial collar, he was an ordained minister, he was an active pastor, He was a member of Congress. He served on 100 committees in Congress. But this guy had a real impact on America because he was president of this university, Princeton University. Now, we have 250 founding fathers in America. Of those 250 founding fathers, 87 of them graduated out of Princeton University. 87 of them came from that one school, the school that he's teaching. A lot of the founding fathers were students that he had in his class. He trained 87 of the founding fathers. And when you look at Witherspoon, and by the way, that university that I just showed you was founded in 1746. That is roughly the time when many of the founding fathers started attending school. You know what the founding statement of Princeton University was, the university of which John Witherspoon is president? Founding statement, 1746, says, "Cursed is all learning that's contrary to the cross of Christ." Now, 87 of the founding fathers came out of that university. Now, back to John Witherspoon. You look at the people whom he trained under that philosophy, it's an incredible list. You see, he personally trained one president, he trained one vice president, he trained three Supreme Court justices, 10 cabinet members, 12 governors, 21 senators, 39 congressmen, all out of that one single university. Now, what did he teach all these guys? Well, we have many of his lectures. The Founding Fathers were very good about printing their materials. There is no shortage of materials from the Founding Fathers. As I point out, we have literally thousands of the Founders' own writings. But I want to read you one of his lectures that he gave his students. Now, here's John Witherspoon. He's a patriot. He's a lover of America. And he's giving his students a description of how you can recognize a true patriot. He's going through and he says, now here's how you can know a patriot. He says, what follows from this? That he is the best friend to American liberty. Here it comes. We can tell who is a friend to America. He said he's the best friend to American liberty, number one, who is the most sincere and the most active in promoting true and undefiled religion. Number two, the one who sits himself with the greatest firmness to bear down on profanity and immorality of every kind. And number three, he said, whoever is an avowed enemy of God, I hesitate not to call him an enemy to his country. Now, that's a pretty interesting definition of an American patriot. He said, an American patriot, you can tell him three ways. He said, number one, they're the ones that are most active in promoting true and undefiled religion. Number two, they're the ones who set themselves with the greatest firmness to bear down on profanity and immorality of every kind. Now, why would they say that? Why bear down on profanity and immorality of every kind? Because they knew that if you were profane and immoral in private, you'd be profane and immoral in public. And if you loved America, if you wanted a good America, you had to work on the private, because it's those elements right there that show up in public office. And then he said third, he said, whoever is an avowed enemy of God, I do not hesitate to call him an enemy to his country. He said, if you don't like God, you're not about to love America, because America stands for exactly the same thing God stands for. We've taken God's principles, we stand for them, same thing. If you don't like God, you're not going to like America at all. Now, he concluded this lecture with this statement. At the last paragraph of this lecture, he says, it is in the man of piety and inward principle that we may expect to find the uncorrupted patriot, the useful citizen, and the invincible soldier. He said, God grant that in America, true religion and civil liberty may always be inseparable. Now, that again is the founding father that trained 87 of the founding fathers. And that's what we were training them with, was the emphasis on the private character. But yet in 1930, we started hearing this rumbling, and in 1960, we really got to where we believed it. Doesn't matter what a guy does in his private life. So much have we believed that last year we had one of the U.S. congressmen who admitted to a third-degree felony, and his constituents said, well, that's his private life. We don't care what he does in his private life. He's still competent to serve in government, and they sent him back again, admitting to a third-degree felony, because that was just private life. You separate the two. There's no way you can separate the two, because you know where the founding fathers got this teaching? It's a clear biblical teaching. That's right. It's Jesus taught it. In Matthew 7, verses 17 through 18, he said, if the root is corrupt, the whole tree is going to be corrupt. He said, you cannot get figs off a thorn bush. It's not going to work. He said, if you got a bad root, you're going to have bad fruit. Now, we said, no, that's not right. You can have good fruit. Doesn't matter what the root is. We don't care what the root is. We're not going to look. You can have good fruit. It'll never work. If the root is corrupt, the fruit is going to be corrupt. That's why they investigated to see, does this guy have a relationship with God? What is his family life like? What is his moral life like? Because if he's got a bad root, we're going to have bad fruit when he gets in government. It's just that simple. And that was the teaching that Jesus had given. But the second thing, not only did we change the way we thought, we even changed the way we acted. We started seeing in 1930, for the first time in America, we started seeing church leaders come up with new advocation for students. They said, listen, young people, you want to do something good for God? Here's what you do. Be a pastor, be a missionary, but don't get in politics. Stay out of law. Don't be a judge. Don't be a public official. Stay out of that stuff. That's not for Christians. We need to get out of it. Well, when you start pulling Christians out of that arena, guess who takes it over? Non-Christians. Now, what we have seen, and by the way, I think the best explanation of what happens when we pull Christians out was given by this man. I'm going to skip a little bit here in the interest of time. Pass through some folks. But if we go right here to
to this man, Charles Finney, he really indicated what happened if the church started pulling itself out of politics. And he did this back in the early 1800s. By the way, if you're not familiar with Charles Finney, great revivalist and evangelist, let me point out to you how this guy got his call to ministry. This guy, Finney, had no intention of going into ministry. No way. He wanted to follow in the footsteps of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry. He wanted to be a lawyer. So he went to law school. He started in law school. The textbook he studied, Blackstone's Commentaries on the Law, I have a copy of it down here, was introduced in 1758. From 1758 till 1920, if you went to law school, your bar exam came out of Blackstone's. That's what you had to know. That was the Bible for lawyers. The Supreme Court uses that backward, forward, up, and down. So here, Finney, studying to be a lawyer, amazing thing. When it gives you the law, it gives you the Bible verse on which the law is based. In the process of reading the Bible, his law book, he read so much of the Bible that he became a Christian from reading his law book, and he got his call to the ministry from studying to be a lawyer. And that's tough to do today. That's almost impossible to do today. But that's the way it was then. So here, O'Finney, and by the way, they said he was a great personal evangelizer, a great personal witnesser, and they say the reason he was so good in one-on-one witnessing was he was such a good lawyer. When he got a witness on the witness stand, that guy was gone. He could pick him apart, question at a time, just tear him. And he did that same thing when he was witnessing. By the time he got done with you, you had no defense for why you shouldn't become a Christian. I mean, when he got done with you, one-on-one witness, there's nothing you can say. The only thing left is to accept Christ. And that's why they said he was such a good evangelist, was because of his legal training. Well, here he is. He's got his legal training. He's got his call to the ministry. He's got this political background. And this is what he told us back early on, right around the turn into the 19th century, early 1800s. He said this. He said, the time has come that Christians must vote for honest men and take consistent ground in politics, or the Lord will curse them. He said, God cannot sustain this free and blessed country, which we love and pray for, unless the church will take right ground. Now, we had done that for years. We stayed right in the middle of the political process, knowing that whoever is in the process is going to vote their kind of people in the office. But in the 30s, we started pulling ourselves out of the process, and so we got away from voting. You know how bad it got in voting? In the 60s, voter turnout in the United States was up around 78% voter turnout. It is now down to 38% voter turnout. And on top of that, of those registered to vote, they represent only 50% of those eligible to vote. So we actually have about 19% of qualified voters or eligible voters who are even voting in the elections now. Now, when you do that, you give up your right to be a democracy or a republic. As I pointed out, the founding fathers said we're a republic, but even if we were a democracy, we've given up our right to be a democracy. That's why today, on national polls say 89% of the nation wants prayer in school. But we don't have it. Why? Because only 19% of the nation expresses an opinion. 82% of the nation opposes homosexual rights, but we have so much of that in law. Why? Because only 19% of the nation expresses themselves politically. You've got 85% of the nation that wants the Ten Commandments back in school. We don't have it. All these numbers, all these figures, we've got a majority, but that majority's not involved, and when it's not involved, we see the things that we have now. When 19% of the people in the United States of America is all that participate in the voting process, my goodness, we are no longer a democracy, much less a republic. Now, as far as what the results of that have been, I think Garfield probably explained it better than anyone else. President Garfield, on an address he gave at the Centennial of the Nation, he said this. Oops, where did Garfield go? I wasn't supposed to skip Garfield. He's supposed to be in there. He's not there. Garfield, he may show up later. I may have him out of order, so just bear with me. But Garfield said that now more than ever before, the people are responsible for the character of their Congress. He said, if that body be ignorant, reckless, and corrupt, it's because the people tolerate ignorance, recklessness, and corruption. You see, that's where we are right now. We don't like what we've got in Congress, but only 19% of us are doing anything about it. We've got guys in Congress bouncing checks at a rate 10 times higher than the rest of us do across the nation. We've got a 500% increase since 1970 of prosecutions of public officials in office, federal prosecutions, 500% increase since 1970. You see, this is a thing that now we see the reflection of that. Well, what happened was, and don't ever say that your kids being exposed to evolution is not going to have any impact on them. When we started pulling ourselves out of the process back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, what we did is we allowed some people into the process that didn't have those biblical base. Now, what we specifically see is that if you look at Supreme Court justices from 1947 to 1987, a great study was done in Washington, D.C. on this, looking at the judges over this 40-year span to see how many of these guys were Christians. How many of them had any kind of a religious background? Because certainly you would not expect that someone with a godly background would give you the kind of decisions we've had in the last 20 to 30 years. So they said, what kind of religious background do these guys have? Now remember, the church started pulling it out in the 30s, pulling itself out in the 30s. So from 1947 to 1987, what should we expect to find? Well, in that same time period, 64% of America profess an affiliation to a denomination, said they were members of the church, and on any given Sunday you would have at least 50% of the nation in church over that span of time. On top of that, we have now about 131 million individuals a Sunday who are active somewhere in the nation. So that's a lot of folks. You would expect that you'd have somewhere close to the same percentage active in the Supreme Court. You know what we found in that study? From 1947 to 1987, that four-decade period, there were only two justices on the court who were active church members, and they were on the court in 1987. They were all recent appointees. Every other judge on the Supreme Court from 1947 to 1987 was either an atheist or non-Christian. You know how tough it is to protect Christian values when you allow atheists and non-Christians to make the decisions on Christian values? Will not work. And that's why, and this is the point about evolution, that's why evolution was important. These guys were trained in evolution, and they believed it with all their heart. And if you believe evolution, you've got to do what these guys did. Consistent with their belief base. They said, no, wait a minute, ho. They said, stop. If we're evolving, we're 200 years more advanced than these guys were back here. We cannot use the same standards they use there because we're not the same people. We're more elevated. We can't be bound by history. We can't be bound by what they did. We have got to come up with new standards that more pertain to the people now because we're more advanced. And so that introduced evolutionary law. We now call it judicial activism. But they got into a point where they believed evolution, they believed in the rejection of fixed standards because we were ever progressing as mankind, so you can't have fixed standards, and that's where history is of no importance. And they said, we've got to go in a new direction. And that new direction was taken in one word. There's a definition of one word in America that's done more to change the direction of America than any other word in America. And it happened in this case, June 25th, 62, Engle Vitale. Now, I told you that the Founding Fathers had a concept of separation of church and state, but the phrase separation of church and state appears in no founding document whatsoever, period. Not in the Constitution, not in the First Amendment, it's not there. But they did have that concept, and that was we won't be one denomination. Now, with this new evolutionary process of law, these judges in 1962 said, no. They said, church does not mean a federally established denomination as it has for the past 170 years. That's not what it means. Church today means a religious activity. Now, that's a new way to look at it. Church means a religious activity. Now, we're not saying the Constitution prohibits the government from establishing a denomination. We're saying the Constitution prohibits the government from being involved in a religious activity. That's a completely different approach to it. You see, that case right there is the one that set us in a new direction, that new definition of church and state. In 1962, if you counted the number of cases in the court system in 1962 which challenged religious expression in public affairs, you know how many cases were in the national court system in 62? Had 12 cases in court. But now with this new definition, by 1984, you know how many cases we had in the court system in 1984 challenging religious expression in public affairs? There were over 6,000 cases in court in 1984. Any conceivable aspect of public affairs that's related to religious values, religious principles, religious activities is in court because of the new evolutionary definition of the First Amendment. Now, that, and let me point out something else interesting about that court. Those nine judges on the court in 1962, of those nine judges on the court in 1962, only one of them had ever been a federal judge before. All the other eight had been politicians all their life. One had been the governor of California for 10 years, one had been a U.S. senator for 10 years, one had been the Secretary of Labor, one was the Assistant Secretary of Labor, one was the founding father of the ACLU, one of them was the ambassador of the United Nations. We had eight politicians on the court. The one judge, Justice Potter Stewart, is the one who dissented in every one of these opinions. He said, guys, you can't do this. This goes against history, this goes against law, this goes against the intent. And the eight politicians said, watch it. And so they moved in a direction without history, without intent, because of this evolutionary thing. Now, that is the core that birthed judicial activism. That's where we say that it started. And it all started right here. Now, the first activity that had to go, obviously, was the one that we know so much about, in school prayer. Now, that had never been established in a denomination, but under the new definition, that is a religious activity, always has been, so it's no longer tolerated. Well, we see the process go step by step by step by step all along. This case, I'm going to show you two more cases just to show you the logic. Because you see, it's important to understand that the people you have in office will rule by what they believe to be true, whether it's true or not. If they're ungodly, they're going to rule by what they believe to be true. If they're godly, they'll rule by what they believe to be true. So this case in 63, the second religious activity that was brought to court was the use of the Bible in schools. Now, I use this case because I want to show you the thought process of these guys. These were not Christians. They were not godly men. They, as I pointed out, were either atheists or non-Christians. So when they struck down the use of the Bible in 1962, or actually 1963 in these two cases, as I pointed before, the court always gives a written opinion for all of its decisions. You know the stated reason given by the Supreme Court in 1963 for removing the Bible out of schools? You go to the law library, pull out the Adventist case, look at it, read it. This is the stated reason given for the removal of the Bible out of schools in 63. The court said that if portions of the New Testament were read without explanation, they could be and had been psychologically harmful to the student. Now, we look at that and you say, you've got to be kidding me. But you know they really believe that? That's why it appears in the Supreme Court dictum. That's why it's in the Supreme Court record. They literally believe that the Bible is not good for you. We've got to move off that. That keeps you tied to the past. Man, that thing is thousands of years old. We've evolved so much since then, you can't have that standard. Well, this one final case, this came out of Kentucky, and it dealt with this little thing right here. Now, in Kentucky, well, drop in their slide, there we go. I have a copy of this. This particular poster right there is about this size. You see, it's the Ten Commandments. Don't steal, don't kill, don't commit adultery, don't bear false witness or lie. It's about this size. It used to hang in the schools in Kentucky. I had to get really close to take the picture. And the court said, now, there's a problem with this. They said, we've already said you can't have the Bible in schools, and the Ten Commandments come out of the Bible. Now, let me point out, that's the basis of civil law in the Western world. I mean, that's why they hang on the wall of the Supreme Court, because that's the basis of our civil law. Don't murder, and don't steal, and don't perjure yourself. That's the basis of law. But, like the court pointed out, that is a religious activity. It does come out of the Bible. So in 1980, this is a statement given by the court. The court said, no more Ten Commandments in schools. You can't even let students see them. It said, if the posted copies of the Ten Commandments were to have any effect at all, it would be to induce the school children to read them. If they were to read them, they'd meditate on them. If they were to meditate on them, they'd respect and obey them, and that would be unconstitutional. You can't let students do that. They would be obeying religious teachings at school, separation of church and state. Now, in working with the Justice Department, let me tell you the most current statistics that we have and show you what the result of this has been. This is the philosophical base of the people who are in office. They are going to do what comes natural to them in the way of what they believe. When I grew up, my parents told me, you stay off the streets at night. Don't get in dark alleys. Stay out of mall parking lots. Stay away from dark places at night. Dangerous place to be. So I start teaching my kids that. You taught your kids that. You were taught that by your parents. I now find out, dealing with the Justice Department, that's not good to teach anymore. That's not right to teach anymore. As a matter of fact, we find that right now, of all the students who are in school, of all crimes committed against students of school age, 17 to 19% of those crimes occur on the street. Right now in America, 68% of all crimes against school-age children occur while they're at school, which means kids are three times safer on the street than they are at school. You want your kids to be safe? Go send them playing in a dark alley somewhere. Now, that's not safe, but that's three times safer than sending them to school. Now, I've twice last year addressed public school teachers in Chicago. Do you know Chicago has three uniformed police officers every campus in Chicago? And in the first 90 days of school, they made 4,306 arrests of students on campus, everything from drugs through murder right there on campus. It's amazing to see the turnaround we've had, but then again, we don't teach things like this because that's not in the philosophical base of the people that we've placed in office. You see, this is where it goes back to, we've got to relearn what our founding fathers taught us. See, Proverbs is so good at this. The book of Proverbs, the first 9 chapters implicitly deal with wisdom. If you want to be wise, you stay in the first 9 chapters of Proverbs. Actually, you stay in the whole book, but especially the first 9 chapters. Heavy duty on wisdom. You know, there's a statement that appears in every chapter in Proverbs, except one chapter, that is repeated over and over again. It says, heed the instruction of your fathers. Listen to the teaching of your father. It goes through all this about listening to your father. Now, we need to do that as a nation. Let me go back. I want to show you a couple of things that our fathers taught us that we have kind of moved away from, lessons that we need to relearn. There was Garfield. I knew he was in there. I just had him out of space. Our fathers taught us lessons that we just don't hear anymore, and one that I want to show you is this man right here. Now, this particular picture, this is a painting of what happened at the first Congress of the United States of America, 1774 Provincial Congress. You can see they started in prayer, but let me tell you, it wasn't a dinky prayer. God bless this Congress. Amen. Now, these guys kicked it off with a 3-hour prayer session to start Congress. But now, when you got the requirements to get into office, that they had to get into office, you had to love prayer by the time you got there anyway. So why not pray? I mean, that's just part of your nature to have that kind of requirement. 3-hour prayer session start this off. Now, what you see over here, you can see George Washington right there. Well, actually, all sorts of people. You've got Patrick Henry there. There's George Washington. There's John Adams. There's Stephen Hopkins. Reverend Duché. Here's John Jay. John Rutledge. But right here, this is 1774. Here is George Washington. Here is John Jay. Now, John Jay is president of these early Congresses. And this is 1774. But 15 years later, 1789, George Washington is now president, and he taps old John Jay, and he says, Jay, I want you in my first administration. I want you to be part of it. And so Jay says, fine. Well, Jay, let me point out, was one of the three men most responsible for the adoption of the Constitution. He, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison are the three men that we have to thank today for the federal Constitution. So he's one of the three men most responsible for it. And George Washington says, I want you to be my Chief Justice. You be my first Chief Justice. So he became Chief Justice. Now let me show you the statement he made. Then I want to show you a second statement he made. This statement, look at this. This is our Chief Justice. This is the teaching of our fathers. He says, Providence is given to our rulers, to our people, the choice of their rulers. And it is the duty, as well as the privilege and interest of a Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for its rulers. And how long has it been since you've heard the Supreme Court say that? Make sure you elect Christians in the next election. Hadn't heard that in years, but that's what we used to teach. Now, it gets better. 3 years before he made that statement, he got a letter from this man, Dr. Jedediah Morse. Dr. Jedediah Morse is one of the top three founding educators in America. He's called the father of American geography. He introduced geography as a course of study in American education. And he writes to Chief Justice. And he said, Chief Justice, in America, is it okay for a Christian to vote for a non-Christian? I mean, can we do that in America? So John Jay writes him back. And the letter John Jay wrote him was great. John Jay said, the question you've asked me of whether a Christian can vote for a non-Christian, he says, is one that I think has not received enough attention either from the clergy or from the laity. He said, however, it appears to me that the best answer to your question is found in 2 Chronicles 19:2. 2 Chronicles 19:2, what is that? I've never memorized that before. I want to read you right out of the Bible what the Chief Justice used to answer that. If you've got a Bible, turn over there. You'll enjoy seeing this. This is how our founding fathers answered policy questions right out of the Scriptures. Now, don't read verse 2 yet, because we need to set it up just a little bit before we get to that punchline. But what you have, this story starts in 2 Chronicles 18. And in 2 Chronicles 18, you've got two kings. You've got King Ahab over Israel, King Jehoshaphat over Judah. King Ahab is one of the most wicked kings in Israel's history. King Jehoshaphat is one of the more righteous kings in Judah's history. Wicked King Ahab corresponds to righteous King Jehoshaphat, and he says, will you come over here and help me fight my enemy? Righteous King Jehoshaphat says, I'll be happy to. Righteous King Jehoshaphat runs over here and makes an alliance with Ahab. They go off to fight an enemy at Ramoth-Gilead. They come back, and Jehoshaphat returns home, and this is where chapter 19 begins. Chapter 19, verse 1, it says, and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned to his house in peace to Jerusalem. Now, this next verse is the answer to the question, can a Christian vote for a non-Christian in America? Listen to what the Chief Justice said, and remember the story. It says, and Jehu, the son of Hanani the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, should you help the wicked and love those that hate the Lord? Because of this, the wrath of the Lord is upon you. Ooh, that's a pretty stiff answer to that question. You see, in John Jay's mind, how can God bless you if you promote wicked and promote the ungodly by putting them in office where they're going to promote their policies? How can God bless you for doing that? Because what you've done is extend wickedness, you've extended unrighteousness. And that was so important that for the first time in America, when we came to election, the first election we had in America, running out of time, first election we had in America where we didn't have a Christian candidate, you ought to see the reaction it brought from the patriots. When we had a choice between two men that were not Christians. You see, this is Abigail Adams. Her husband had just retired from office as president, and he's gone back to Massachusetts. But we've got a problem here. The third presidential election, or the election for the third president, was between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, neither of whom were Christians. And that scared her to death. She said, I have got to stay in Washington, D.C. and see what happens to this election. We have here an election in which we don't have a Christian choice. And so she wrote a letter to her sister on February the 7th, 1801, and listen to what the description was of what happens when we don't have a choice. And listen to how it scared these patriots when we didn't have a godly choice. She says, never were a people placed in more difficult circumstances than the virtuous part of our countrymen are at the present crisis. She says, I have turned and turned and overturned in my mind at various times the merits and demerits of the two candidates. She said, long acquaintance, private friendship, and the full belief that the private character of Jefferson is much better than that of Burr inclines me to Jefferson. But have we any claim to the protection of God when we have, against warning, admonition, and advice, chosen as our president a man who makes no pretensions to the belief of the all-wise supreme governor of the world directing the events of his life? She said, now I do not mean that Jefferson is an atheist, for I do not think that he is. But he believes religion only useful as it may be made a political engine. She said, if we ever saw a day of darkness in America, I fear this is one. I mean, here we had an election where we weren't going to have a Christian choice. You know what that means? There's going to be a non-Christian person in office who's going to make policy for the rest of the nation. And my goodness, how can God bless that? You see, that was how fearful it was to not understand Matthew 7. If the root's corrupt, the fruit's going to be corrupt. If the root's righteous, the fruit's going to be righteous. And that's the way the patriots describe government. That's how they maintain government. And that's what we've got to do today. Closing challenge. Back to Finney again. Finney said the church must take right ground in regard to politics. He said politics are part of the religion in the country as this, and Christians must do their duty to the country as part of their duty to God. He said God will bless or curse this country according to the course that Christians take in politics. And that's where it is. It's back to voting. It's back to going to precinct meetings. By the way, that's coming up the end of, March. Coming up in March. Make sure you attend your precinct meetings. And then some of you consider running for office. We get godly people in office. We get godly policies in office. It's just that simple. So those are three things we can do to take right ground. Well, guys, I appreciate the opportunity to be back with you again this year. God bless you.